Bloomberg Business Week for January 2026. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Pat Livingston, and I have just finished digging through this absolutely colossal stack of sources, all outlining the predictions and, well, the high-stakes financial bets that are really defining 2026.
And I'm Chris Sinclair. And this issue, it's not just a collection of reports, and you really have to see it as an essential guide to navigating the year. We are going deep today.
Very deep.
From, you know, the spectacular crashes of celebrity meme coins, which one source describes as a maximum value extraction machine, all the way to the corporate culture wars that are tearing apart iconic retailers like Target.
So our mission here is to distill the absolute most important nuggets from all this material. We're trying to identify the risks, the rewards, and, you know, the strategies you really need to be aware of to survive and hopefully thrive.
Exactly. We're connecting these threads that might seem unrelated on the surface. We're finding the signal and the noise.
We want you to walk away not just informed, but feeling like you have a true shortcut to understanding this this whole financial and cultural landscape.
Then before we jump into the economic analysis, just a quick point on accuracy. We always strive for perfection, but, you know, there was a small error in the December issue's joint ventures puzzle.
Aye.
For anyone who took a crack at it, the correct answers were 7, Snap-on, and 8, extra virgin. So you can consider that our moment of quick administrative transparency.
Noted. All right, let's start with a big and frankly kind of frightening picture. Brad Stone's cover story, Beware the Bubble, really sets the tone. It reaches all the way back to 1929 and the economist Roger Babson.
Right.
2 months before Black Monday, he issued this dire warning that a crash was coming and that it may be terrific. And the market did dip. They called it the Babson break. But the optimism around new tech, you know, things like the radio, was just so powerful that the market rebounded, only to crash spectacularly later.
And that historical context is, it's eerie, especially given the irrational exuberance surrounding AI right now.
It's a perfect parallel.
It truly is. We are in the speculative phase of a major technological cycle. The spending that tech companies are committing to the pursuit of artificial general intelligence, or AGI, that, you know, holy grail of AI, is simply staggering.
What are the numbers?
They are on pace to spend nearly $1.2 trillion annually on data centers by 2030. And that entire sum, it's predicated on AGI materializing and then translating into massive guaranteed future profits.
It sounds like a game of musical chairs where everyone is just racing to build infrastructure based on a promise. An analyst, Eva Daron, even suggests these companies are playing Mad Libs, just plugging moonshot technology into any problem they have. But is this limited just to AI?
Not at all. And that's the critical distinction. If we define a speculative bubble as an asset whose worth rises, you know, unsustainably beyond its fundamental value, then the phenomenon is, well, it's universal right now. It is a bubble economy.
So give us the list. What other assets are inflating in lockstep?
We're seeing bubbles in assets that historically provide stability. First, gold. Its price has jumped by nearly 2/3, 64% in just 1 year, which reflects this profound global anxiety.
Okay, what's second?
Second, government debt. We are talking about major nations collectively operating deeper in the red than they have since World War II. This massive global borrowing, it just fuels the illusion of endless liquidity.
And third, this one seems like the big one.
Third, and perhaps the most high-risk element right now, is private credit.
This is that $3 trillion unregulated market for high-risk loans, right? Often used to finance the exact infrastructure we just mentioned, like those $1.2 trillion data centers.
Exactly. And this lack of regulation is why financial titans are sounding the alarm. Jeffrey Gundlach, the CEO of DoubleLine Capital, has flatly called it garbage lending.
I saw that. And Jamie Dimon from JPMorgan Chase warned this kind of growth is a recipe for a financial crisis.
Because when the system is this exposed, a crash in one area, say, AI has these immediate cascading effects on the loans that finance the whole enterprise in the first place.
It transforms the market into a casino, which leads right to the cultural shift the article focuses on.
Mm.
6 in 10 Americans now explicitly aspire to extreme wealth.
Right.
But the stat that really jumped off the page for me was that 70% of Gen Z and millennials say they want to be billionaires.
This is the casino economy in full effect. They're treating financial markets like a slot machine, just hoping for the quick life-changing payout rather than focusing on, you know, the intrinsic long-term value of a company.
And this cultural shift is amplified by the attention economy, TikTok, Reddit, the internet, where everyone knows about the latest money-making opportunity instantly, driving this extreme, coordinated herd behavior.
And that exuberance spills right over into our consumption habits. The source provided this fascinating list of cultural bubbles, showing that this speculative, attention-driven mindset is just, it's everywhere.
It really highlights how attention equals value right now, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. You have the cyclical celebrity bubbles, the Sydney Sweeney, the Pedro Pascal, that viral 6 to 7 phenomenon. Then you have the rise of collectibles, which is dubbed the La Bubble, referring to the cute zoological stuffies sold by China's Pop Mart.
Which trade on FOMO and novelty.
Exactly. And the protein bubble is an incredible example of cultural consumption meeting biology.
So the protein bubble, this is being driven partly by the growing number of people on GLP-1 weight loss drugs who are seeking smaller portions but need higher protein content in those portions. It's a pharmaceutical trend literally reshaping food spending.
Right. And even in media, we see it in the sheer volume of niche Substack newsletters, the flood of celebrity-hosted podcasts, Amy Poehler's Good Hang or Meghan Markle's Confessions of a Female Founder, and the wave of authorized biopics. As W. David Marks notes, the internet has made our reference groups global, which just accelerates these collective moments of focus and speculation.
So if this casino economy is so over-leveraged and fragile, what's the worst-case scenario?
Carlota Perez, who studies these technological cycles, she provides the stark warning. She believes if these hyper-speculative areas, AI and crypto, were to crash simultaneously, it could trigger a global collapse of unimaginable proportions. The productive golden ages, she argues, only follow when finance is properly reined in, not perpetually pumped with liquidity and bailed out. It's a very high-stakes position to be in.
That leads directly to Stacey Vanek Smith's piece, which titled This State, The Alice in Wonderland Economy. It just captures the atmosphere of tenuous optimism perfectly. Moody's Analytics sets the risk of a 2026 recession at 42%.
And Mark Zandi, the economist, he summed up the current outlook brilliantly. They mostly expect to get through 2026 without a downturn, but he warned, and I'm quoting here, nothing else can go wrong. Like, nothing. We're pretty much on the edge.
So the entire economic outlook rests on 4 load-bearing pillars. And if one fails, Zandi says, we're toast. What are those 4 pillars?
Labor, inflation, the consumer, and AI. Now, labor and inflation appear stable, but the consumer is where the fragility really lies. Consumer spending accounts for 70% of U.S. GDP, but the data is deceiving.
How so?
Consumer spending has remained strong, but it's entirely propped up by the wealthy. The wealthiest 10% of Americans now generate nearly half of all U.S. spending.
Which, as Evan Sheehan of Deloitte noted, implies that the bottom half of the economy may already be in a recession.
Exactly. The danger here is systemic. If there's a stock market rout or an AI bubble pops, the wealthy who feel flush could sharply cut back their spending, and that would immediately pull the rug out from under the entire economy.
So the stability of the entire system rests on that final pillar,
yeah,
the AI engine. The promise of expansion, primarily data center construction, is keeping things steady. And that promise is concentrated in the Magnificent Seven: Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla, which make up over a third of the S&P 500's value.
It is entirely a faith-based economy. As long as the market maintains faith that AI will deliver unimaginable returns, the economy holds. If the fundamental value fails to materialize, we become completely decoupled from reality. That's why the article cited Tweedledee. If it was so, it might be. And if it were so, it would be. But as it isn't, it ain't. That skepticism really defines the 2026 forecast.
That Magnificent Seven faith-based economy leads us directly into our first industry deep dive, Hollywood. Let's look at Lucas Shaw's piece on the existential threat and the opportunity AI presents to content creators.
The industry is in a state of cognitive dissonance. I mean, they fear AI job displacement, but they recognize its efficiency. A great proof of concept came from director Timur Bekmambetov, known for massive action thrillers. He made a low-budget film, The Man with a Shattered World, almost entirely generated by AI.
And what's so clever about that is he made the AI's flaws a central feature of the plot. The film is about a soldier with a traumatic brain injury, so the glitches and visual hallucinations produced by the AI actually reflect the character's mental state.
And it cost a fraction of a standard film, which shows that AI's revolution is already here. But when he tried to integrate AI into his Amazon thriller, Mercy, Amazon banned it. Why? The actors were deeply unhappy.
And this reflects the looming labor crisis. The previous writers and actors strikes in 2023 were heavily motivated by AI concerns, and those contracts expire again in 2026.
So studios are trying to sell efficiency to investors while desperately trying not to provoke another costly labor stoppage. It's a real tightrope walk.
The IP crisis really escalated last October with the release of OpenAI's Sora 2. It had the technical capability to allow users to generate videos featuring copyrighted characters and even famous people unless those entities specifically opted out.
Right, which forced a massive industry response. The uproar required OpenAI to revise its policy to demand an opt-in requirement. But the most significant tectonic shift came in December when Disney,
the ultimate guardian of intellectual property.
Exactly. Disney signed a $1 billion licensing deal with OpenAI, and that signaled the final acceptance. The genie is out of the bottle. You have to learn to utilize it.
The source notes that the established legal framework for copyright is relatively strong, but the legal protection around the use of a person's likeness, the right to publicity, name, image, and likeness, you know, Tom Hanks's face or Lady Gaga's voice, is much fuzzier.
And that's where the talent adaptation is happening fast. Entertainment lawyer Kevin Yorn is now including specific clauses in every client contract to govern the use of digital replicas. He even took the aggressive step of trying to file for copyright protection for one of his clients' voices, which is an uncertain legal maneuver, but he has to act because, as he said, AI collapses the boundary between a person and a file.
We've also seen the battle lines clearly drawn. Scarlett Johansson claimed OpenAI mimicked her voice after she declined to participate in their voice assistant project. Meanwhile, Matthew McConaughey is taking the offensive. He's licensing his voice through 11 Labs and investing in the company, seeing it as a new, massive revenue stream. It's a classic innovator's dilemma playing out in Hollywood. Speaking of industries having to adapt quickly to consumer shifts, let's pivot to lunch and Dina Shanker's analysis of the fast casual salad crisis.
This is a perfect microeconomic story of macro pressures. Fast food giants like McDonald's and Burger King are bouncing back using aggressive discount deals like $5 and $8 meals to win back customers. The fast casual industry, which, you know, just can't compete on the price of cheap meat and fries, is hitting a consumer spending limit.
And the paradox is that the healthy fast casual lunch bowls are often too expensive and too calorie dense, frequently exceeding 1,000 calories. So the chains are failing both the cost-conscious customer and the health-conscious customer.
So the proposed solution is a total reversal of the traditional fast food model. Traditionally, fast food offers more food for slightly more money. Fast casual must start offering less food for a discounted price. This addresses the cost stinginess of consumers and, crucially, that growing segment of GLP-1 weight loss drug users who are seeking smaller portions.
But if they cut portions and lower prices, don't they risk losing the high ticket price customers to the traditional fast food chains who are offering even cheaper, bigger meals? Is the goal not to compete with McDonald's, but to redefine their value proposition entirely?
That's the key. They cannot compete with McDonald's on price or volume. Their value proposition must become healthy, sufficient, and faster. They have to cater specifically to that new consumer base, the GLP-1 users, the young professional watching their budget, who now actively believe less is more. They're trying to extract profit by catering to a niche that fast food giants are structurally unable to serve.
That is a tidy summary of consumer behavior adjusting to inflation and biology at the same time. Now let's turn to the third deep dive, luxury. Amanda Mull details the massive shift in how wealthy individuals consume expensive goods, fueling the luxury resale boom.
This trend is entirely driven by the staggering price surges in new luxury goods. Companies like LVMH have done fantastically well, seeing revenue top 86 billion euros. But they responded to that pandemic-era cash flow by increasing prices far faster than inflation. Luxury goods prices jumped 44% since 2019.
And the Chanel Classic flat bag is the iconic example. In 2019, the medium size was around $5,800. By early 2025, that same bag was $10,200, with some models hitting over $11,000. That's an investment, not a consumer purchase.
When prices decouple that radically from accessible value, shoppers inevitably seek that value elsewhere. And this frustration is funneling money directly into the secondhand fashion market. Resale is currently growing 3 times faster than the market for new goods.
3 times faster. The global secondhand market is projected to hit $360 billion by 2030, which tells you everything you need to know about where consumer psychology is heading.
And this trend is penetrating traditionally resistant markets. The luxury resale market in China grew an estimated 35% in 2025 alone. The bottom line for investors is that this is a permanent structural shift. New luxury brands have to factor the secondary market into their pricing strategy, or they risk the secondary market completely dictating the real accessible price point of their goods.
The economic anxiety fueling the fast casual crisis and the luxury resale boom leads us naturally to the political landscape. When the economy feels precarious and unfair, political discontent is, well, it's inevitable. Wes Kosova's analysis of the Democratic Party heading into the midterms shows widespread frustration.
That's the key finding. Over two-thirds of Democrats are frustrated with their party leaders. There's a widespread feeling that the aging, entrenched establishment is ineffective against the current Republican administration and unable to deliver on core promises like affordability.
The targets of this frustration are clearly identified. Chuck Schumer, at 75, is widely viewed as losing his authority. Progressives were furious after he allowed a handful of Democratic senators to end the 2025 government shutdown without securing major concessions.
Which led progressives like Ro Khanna to call him no longer effective.
Exactly. And in the House, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is struggling for visibility. His own quote, "I'm trying to figure out what leverage we actually have," is not an inspiring call to arms. If the Democrats manage to win back the House, Jeffries faces a near-certain bruising fight for the Speaker's gavel.
So who are these young left-wing insurgents bringing the fight? The article profiles four key figures.
Let's hear them.
First, Zohar Namdani, the new NYC mayor. His long-shot victory immediately put affordability, housing, groceries, childcare at the forefront of the national debate. His challenge, as the source notes, is that moving from easy campaign promises to difficult delivery often tempers that initial revolutionary zeal.
Second, Joanna Mendoza, who embodies the kind of candidate the Democrats feel they need. Poor background, Navy and Marine veteran, LGBTQ single mother, running in a key Tucson district on healthcare and veterans' rights. She's already generating serious fundraising.
Third is Graham Plattner, the ex-Marine, oyster farmer, and Sanders-backed insurgent running against Maine's Seven Collins on an anti-oligarchy platform. He represents that authentic, rural, progressive voice, but he faces significant challenges due to his controversial online past, calling himself a communist and having a military tattoo resembling a Nazi symbol covered up.
And that has led the establishment Democrats to back the state governor instead, showing that internal fracturing.
Right. And fourth is Mallory McMorrow, the Michigan state senator, famous for her viral video denouncing groomer attacks.
Yeah.
She's running for the U.S. Senate, but strategically labels herself a pragmatist, keeping her focus firmly on jobs, housing, and healthcare in a knife-edge state.
The analysis also provides a key insight into 2028. Ah. The future contenders are shifting from senators to governors.
That's a big shift. The list includes Wes Moore, Gavin Newsom, J.B. Pritzker, Josh Shapiro, and Gretchen Whitmer, all state executives building national profiles. Plus, Pete Buttigieg, an AOC, who is reportedly weighing a run for either the president's desk or Schumer's Senate desk. This shift to executive experience is telling.
Now let's transition from domestic political discontent to the complex geopolitical reality explored in Christopher Beam's article, "Give Up on Winning Against China." The central thesis is that the U.S.'s efforts to undermine China's economy have, for the most part, failed.
The story begins with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent trying to project confidence by claiming China had a losing hand, a pair of twos in the trade game. But the late October trade deal revealed the U.S. was the one bluffing, ultimately reversing an expansion of export controls that the administration had previously claimed were non-negotiable.
So China just shrugged off the pressure and emerged with its systemic strength on clearer display.
And the source reminds us that predictions of China's collapse, like Gordon Chang's 2001 forecast, have repeatedly failed. The consensus view is softening because China is no longer just a fast follower. It is presenting a viable, potentially more feasible model of development than the West.
And the data supports this idea of near parity, doesn't it?
Absolutely. China leads globally in critical 21st century metrics, rare earths production at 69%, solar power capacity 46%, the EV car fleet 59%, and factory robots 43% of installations in 2024. They are dominating clean energy technology and manufacturing scale.
The economic choke points for the U.S. are alarming. The U.S. relies on China for ingredients in nearly 700 medicines, a sensitive dependency that the U.S. didn't even risk bringing up in trade talks. And of course, China controls those rare earths.
The U.S. counterlever is high-end AI microprocessors like the NVIDIA Blackwell chip, banned from sale to China. But Li Hongbin of the Stanford Center argues China can survive without them, while the U.S. cannot survive without those Chinese medicine ingredients or rare earths.
Plus, China uses elaborate smuggling networks and dedicated self-production efforts, like Huawei's competitive chips, to bypass those controls.
And they're investing heavily in future dominance, leading in quantum communications, and rapidly advancing in quantum computing and AI patents, which experts refer to as the DeepSeek moment. Even militarily, the gap is closing fast. Chinese shipbuilders produced more vessels last year than the U.S. has built since WWII, and they launched an aircraft carrier comparable to U.S. Navy carriers.
But the source is careful to balance this. China still faces massive long-term challenges, right?
Oh, absolutely. The housing market wreckage, deflation, a rapidly aging population that will lose 25% of its working age adult in 25 years, and the persistent risk of the middle income trap.
The final psychological takeaway is the softening U.S. perception. This may be due to shared cultural products like TikTok and the Labubus, or simply the fact that China's relative stability looks appealing compared to the chaos of U.S. politics. The conclusion is clear. Hoping for China's demise is simply not a rational or winning strategy.
And before moving on, for those interested in diving further into this topic, the sources recommended five specific resources: Rui Ma's Tech Buzz China Insider Newsletter, the China Talk podcast, Kevin Xu's Interconnected Newsletter, Yang Cheng's essays on U.S.-China relations, and the Wire China website for data-centered research.
Now let's pivot to an existential threat to personal identity. Izzy Lipowski's piece, The Age of Proving You're Human. The crisis of trust is total. It started with Hani Farid, the digital forensics expert, who admitted he couldn't shake the suspicion that he was talking to a deepfake of Barack Obama during a video call.
And he couldn't ask the former president to perform the old hand-waving trick to prove his reality, because Farid himself has proven that trick is obsolete. He flawlessly swapped his own face for Sam Altman's on a video call. The guarantee that a video call implies a human presence, it's just over.
AI is now effortlessly breaking our traditional defenses. LLMs are smashing CAPTCHAs, and in a recent Turing test, GPT 4.5 fooled human judges 73% of the time. This has led to high-level financial crime. That Hong Kong employee who sent $25 million to a scammer impersonating the CFO via deepfake.
And political interference, the voice clone that impersonated Secretary of State Marco Rubio to foreign ministers. And since technology can't reliably fix the problem yet, humans are resorting to devising their own informal Turing tests and, bizarrely, self-censoring their own behavior to avoid sounding robotic.
This is where the story gets really surreal. Humans are suppressing habits, seen as AI tells. One PR firm, Bahava Communications, had a ban on the M-dash.
A ban on punctuation?
Specifically because ChatGPT overuses it. They feared that clients would assume they were passing off a chatbot's work if they saw too many dashes.
And Wikipedia editors are actively scanning entries for AI giveaways, including the overuse of the word delves. Copywriters feel they are censoring their own work in what the article called an internet-wide witch hunt. We built the machines, and now they are plagiarizing our quirks, forcing us to abandon them to prove our authenticity.
Companies are implementing AI tripwires in the hiring process. Kyle Ortega, CEO of the Bullet Group, started asking applicants to name their Hogwarts house or include a specific pop culture reference in their cover letters. In one listing, less than 3% of the over 900 applicants followed those instructions.
So it dramatically reduced the pool, and analog solutions are resurfacing too. Sam Altman suggested families adopt secret code words to defend against sophisticated voice clone scams, an idea the UK's Starling Bank pushed in a marketing campaign.
And people are trying to catch customer service agents out by asking obscure technical questions, like the definition of the Navier-Stokes equations, hoping to hear a human struggle with the answer rather than a chatbot supplying it instantly.
On the tech front, we see some fixes. Cisco Systems is adding biometric verification to its application process, and major finance companies like JPMorgan Chase are using deepfake busting tools like Reality Defender to detect synthetic media in real time.
But the most controversial fix is Sam Altman's Tools for Humanity project, World ID. This requires users to scan their iris using the orb to generate a cryptographically secured ID-proving personhood.
And the dystopian potential of a single entity issuing credentials of humanity has been widely criticized and has led to the orb being banned in countries like Brazil.
The profound takeaway here is that we've trained probabilistic machines to be too good at predicting what a human would do. Now, to distinguish ourselves from them, we're actively struggling to figure out how to act less like ourselves. We'll transition now to our global snapshots, looking at niche stories that nonetheless provide critical context for the world in 2026. First, circling back to the U.S.-China rivalry, rare earths mining imbalance.
This is the hard resource reality that underpins the geopolitical rivalry. China mines 70% and processes nearly 90% of the world's 17 rare earth elements, which are vital components in everything from high-end smartphones to Javelin missiles.
The U.S. happily outsourced this messy, environmentally hazardous process for decades, but now it faces a profound structural dependency. Unlike oil and gas, where the U.S. could innovate its way to independence with fracking.
Right, you can't just frack for rare earths. Critically, the U.S. lacks heavy rare earths like dysprosium and terbium, which are essential for high-performance magnets and military applications. Even the only U.S. rare earth mine in the Mojave Desert only recently stopped sending its material overseas for processing. China's willingness to use these as bargaining chips creates a serious long-term supply chain deficit for the West.
Now let's look at a critical example of proactive long-term investment in domestic stability, which provides a blueprint for effective public-private partnerships. Virginia Housing.
This is a great example of a high-stakes, long-term bet. The Commonwealth of Virginia faces a massive employment challenge. 350,000 new workers are expected over the next 10 years. That requires roughly 200,000 new homes to support that growth.
And Virginia Housing, one of the top housing finance agencies, manages a colossal $16 billion mortgage portfolio.
That scale requires institutional stability and expertise. They have worked with Wells Fargo for over two decades for things like interest rate hedging, liquidity, and bond originations. This stability allows Virginia Housing to innovate aggressively.
How so?
Well, they're funding everything from massive workforce housing projects to innovative grants for 3D printed homes to accelerate construction. As Rebecca Reap from Wells Fargo noted, it's about bringing nationwide expertise to drive those affordable housing solutions. This isn't just a regional story, it's a national blueprint for how states can leverage private financial institutions to solve massive housing shortfalls.
Moving on to another geopolitical flashpoint, let's look at Malaysia, where the rise of local brands is being driven by unexpected international conflicts.
This is a powerful story of localization fueled by public sentiment. Widespread pro-Palestinian sentiment in Malaysia led to extensive boycotts of U.S. and Israeli-linked international brands. Major corporations like McDonald's, Coca-Cola products, and KFC, the latter even closing dozens of outlets in Indonesia, have suffered significant economic fallout.
And the expert analysis from Adib Zelkapli suggests this shift to homegrown alternatives appears to have staying power. He called the change permanent, driven by the fact that Palestine is a paramount foreign policy issue in Malaysian politics.
And the success story is Ahmad's Fried Chicken, launched by Lelatul Sarajana Mode Ismail. It grew from a food truck to 35 outlets in just over a year, and is projected to hit 110 outlets by the end of 2026. Furthermore, a local Malaysian brand, Zeus Coffee, is expanding across Southeast Asia, tailoring products like Ube-flavored coffee in the Philippines to reflect this permanent shift away from undifferentiated global brands.
So our next snapshot takes us to Nigeria, focusing on a dangerous health crisis tied to agriculture, the pervasive use of EU-banned pesticides.
The human tragedy is just devastatingly real. It's highlighted by the story of Abdullah Yusuf, whose 12-year-old daughter died of leukemia, linked to the highly toxic chemicals he uses on his farm. Farmers are using chemicals like mancozeb, imidacloprid, atrazine, and paraquat, all banned in the European Union.
The statistics are grim. At least 450 deaths in Nigeria between 2008 and 2022 are attributed to pesticides and herbicides. Public health experts stress that there is substantial scientific proof linking these chemicals to cancer and neurological disorders.
The Nigerian Medical Association is calling for education and stricter enforcement. However, the regulatory environment is complex. Proposed legislation to create a pesticide council may actually loosen existing restrictions, prompting counter-legislation drafted by an agricultural industry advocacy group to strengthen existing agencies and set a firm schedule for phasing out these hazardous pesticides. It is a fundamental battle between agricultural output, profit, and human health.
Moving now to defense technology, let's look at the Golden Dome missile defense layer, the U.S. multi-layered system designed to intercept nuclear warheads.
The layered defense is key to national security. It starts with space-based interceptors to hit warheads high in the atmosphere, incorporates ground-based interceptors, and utilizes the sophisticated AGA system deployed on ships. Crucially, the system relies on refueling tankers, specifically the KC-135, to ensure U.S. aircraft can maintain continuous high-altitude surveillance coverage over threats for extended periods.
And the future of protection involves directed energy, specifically the U.S. Army's Portable High-Energy Laser, or PHFEL.
Right, a PHFEL. It's designed to provide localized, directed fire protection capability against incoming threats, moving defense from kinetic interception to speed of light engagement. This ongoing modernization reflects the massive financial and strategic commitment required to maintain deterrence.
Finally, let's profile Marcos Galperin, the influential tech titan behind Mercado Libre. He is Argentina's richest man, and his company, with a $105 billion market cap, is an e-commerce and fintech giant operating across 18 countries.
And Mercado Libre's payment platform, Mercado Pago, is no longer just a competitor to traditional banks. It is now actively pursuing banking licenses, signaling its ambition to fully integrate into the traditional financial system. It employs 100,000 people and is a true Latin American powerhouse.
Galperin is also a highly outspoken political activist. He strongly supports Javier Milei's free market reforms, advocates for cryptocurrencies, and uses X to criticize wokeism and biased journalism. He called the Trump administration's $20 billion backstop for Milei very positive. The name of his company, Free Market in Spanish, reflects his core ideology.
And his long-term vision involves AI to further democratize finance. He envisions an AI advisor helping Mercado Pago users pay bills and automatically allocating extra income to investment funds tailored to their risk appetite. He really encapsulates the ideological and technological high-stakes future of Latin American capitalism.
Let's turn now to the first of our three major feature deep dives, which focuses on the biggest infrastructure gamble in tech history, Oracle's Project Stargate. This story is fascinating because the deal, worth $300 billion, began with an unsolicited LinkedIn message.
It sounds like a tech fairy tale, but it's true. OpenAI was desperate for computing power after their initial plans for X-shaped data centers with Elon Musk's XAI fell through in spring 2024. Peter Hochul, OpenAI's infrastructure chief, reached out to Oracle sales leaders via LinkedIn. Oracle, an unlikely cloud challenger, was ready to commit.
And the scale of this $300 billion commitment, which is just for server rental, is just unprecedented. To fulfill this, Oracle must build about 5 data center complexes globally, requiring millions of chips and consuming 4.5 gigawatts of power.
To put 4.5 gigawatts in perspective, that is more electricity than all the homes in Chicago combined. This is a massive multi-year construction project. The only problem is that the initial 2027 completion dates for some key U.S. data centers have already slipped to 2028 due to labor and material shortages.
Which increases the financial pressure. And Oracle is resorting to incredibly costly novel methods to get these sites online quickly, including running entire massive sites with gas generators. For the Texas campus alone, that method is projected to cost over $1 billion annually.
I mean, that just screams desperation to fulfill the contract. And the audacity, of course, comes from the top. Larry Ellison, Oracle's co-founder and chairman, his half-century history in tech is marked by sharp elbows, massive overpromising, and ethical flexibility, perfectly summarized by his infamous quote, "I cannot run this business and tell the truth to the customers. It's not possible."
Ellison famously missed the start of cloud computing entirely, calling it gibberish in 2008, which allowed competitors like AWS and Salesforce to dominate the market. His former CEO, Safra Catz, was also reluctant to chase the lower-margin cloud business.
And that reluctance shows in the data. Even today, Oracle only holds 3% of the cloud infrastructure market. They only gained any traction during the pandemic with crucial deals for Zoom and TikTok's Project Texas. That experience, however, prepared them for the scale of the current AI obsession, enabling them to pursue this massive debt.
The company signaled its future priorities during the 2025 CEO transition. Katz was replaced by co-CEOs, but Clay Magorek, the cloud infrastructure chief, received a compensation package $150 million higher than his co-CEO, Mike Sicilia, who handles sales. Ellison, naturally, remains the executive chairman and implicit forever boss.
This leads us back to the financial risks. Oracle is deeply in debt and has seen negative free cash flow for the first time since 1992. This massive infrastructure bet is projected to absorb about $70 billion in free cash flow losses over the rest of the decade before it even begins to turn a profit.
And Stargate relies entirely on the notion of unprecedented continuing demand for AI computing. But the deal structure is terrifying for Oracle. OpenAI has the option to walk away after 5 years, long before Oracle's 15-year leases on these massive centers expire.
Rival skepticism is running high. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella explicitly criticized the scale of OpenAI's demands. He said a request for a dedicated multi-gigawatt data center in one location for training made sense for OpenAI's goals, but was illogical for Azure's business model. Microsoft actually gave up its right of first refusal for OpenAI's business, signaling profound concern.
Analyst Galuria summed up the stakes with some dark humor, outlining three scenarios. One, Oracle reduces forecasts but salvages work. Two, OpenAI collapses and the contract dissolves. Or three.
The third one is my favorite. OpenAI achieves superintelligence, spends $1.4 trillion, and none of us have to ever work again, and Oracle is fine.
A nice thought. The initial news drove Oracle's share price up, adding $250 billion to its market value and briefly making Ellison the world's wealthiest person. But that price has since dropped significantly, reflecting the market's sober realization that Oracle is simply one of many companies now chasing OpenAI, and that the financial logic of these massive irreversible investments is shaky absent the realization of technological singularity. Our second major feature, Deep Dive, focuses on a company struggling with an identity crisis, corporate arrogance, and the backlash economy. Target. Brian Cornell is stepping down as CEO, but staying on as board chair, a move that displeased investors who wanted an outsider, resulting in the stock dropping 6% when COO Michael Fiddalk was named his successor. Cornell's legacy is defined by massive swings. High points include pulling out of the disastrous Canadian expansion in 2015 and developing $30 billion in popular house brands. But the lowlights include recent sales declines, political controversies, and what observers describe as a profound culture of high self-regard or arrogance. Right, retail analyst Neil Saunders suggested that Target's attitude has always been, we know best, which works when you are executing perfectly, but becomes a major hindrance when you're trying to apologize or course correct. Fiddalk now faces the challenge of making Target cool again.
And to understand the cool factor they lost, you have to look back at the Tarzay myth. During the Bob Ulrich era, Target distinguished itself from Walmart by focusing on clean stores, short checkout lines, and high design through partnerships with designers like Michael Graves. They gave customers the feeling of getting fine design to the masses.
That era was known for savvy, witty marketing, like buying all the ad space in a 2005 issue of The New Yorker and filling it with clever illustrations. Ulrich's successor, Steinoffel, moved away from that, trying to become more like Walmart by slashing prices and de-emphasizing style.
And Steinhoffel's tenure was plagued by two major debacles. The Canadian failure, where stores opened with empty shelves and higher prices, and the devastating 2013 hacker breach that stole 40 million credit card numbers. This eventually forced the board to bring in the outsider, Cornell.
Cornell had immediate successes, like the exit from Canada and the $7 billion remodeling plan, which prepared them to prosper during the pandemic. Revenues soared 20% in 2020, but the trouble started in 2022 when inflation spiked and they were stuck with a massive backlog of inventory, cutting annual profit by 55%.
And operationally, their continued strategy of using stores as digital fulfillment centers caused chaos. Employees prioritized online orders, shelves were frequently empty, and checkout lines grew longer. All of this unfolded while Cornell, who had his mandatory retirement age waived, faced criticism for his hands-off style, often leading internal meetings infrequently from Florida.
But the defining issue became the backlash economy. Target has a history of standing by progressive policies, such as the transgender bathroom policy. But in 2023, the conservative backlash erupted over their Pride collection, specifically targeting tuck-friendly swimsuits, leading to threats against employees.
And the situation was compounded when Target, following the return of the administration, rolled back its DEI policies in 2024, ending formal black employment programs and pulling out of human rights campaign surveys. This resulted in a progressive boycott. Groups like Twin Cities Pride publicly rejected a $50,000 donation.
So they managed to alienate both sides of the culture war simultaneously.
Exactly. And the result is visible damage to their brand reputation. Target's Harris Poll reputation score has fallen significantly, now sitting below Walmart. Internally, employee confidence is low. 40% of employees in a summer survey reported being unconfident about the company's future.
So Fiddalk's new strategy, priority 1 through 10, is simply growth. He aims to reclaim leadership in style and design, using an AI-powered trend brain to inform house labels like Wild Fable. But his tenure started poorly. 1,800 corporate position cuts marred by poor execution, with employees often learning they were laid off via media reports or a glitchy video conference call.
And the customer verdict, represented by shoppers like Lisa Crampsey, is a shift to alternatives like Costco, because the DEI rollback signaled a loss of principle. Target's biggest challenge in 2026 isn't just economic headwinds, but the fact that, in trying to navigate the culture wars, they lost their distinct high-design identity.
Our final major feature deep dive takes us back to the financial Wild West. The meme coin phenomenon, specifically the Trump family's involvement, which the article labels a maximum value extraction machine. This story opens at the $2,500 per ticket crypto ball before the inauguration, where political figures like Speaker Mike Johnson mingled with crypto leaders.
This high roller event was the perfect backdrop for the announcement. Donald Trump used Truth Social to announce his Trumpy coin, causing an immediate price spike. Melania followed suit 2 days later, launching her Melania coin. These are meme coins, digital tokens based on nothing but hype and speculation.
The coins briefly soared to an estimated $50 billion in value before crashing dramatically. Trump is down 88% and Melania is down 99% from their peaks. The analysis suggests the Trump team cashed out over $350 million.
And in the interest of impartial reporting, the political implications here are serious. Critics immediately alleged corruption, viewing the anonymous nature of the coins as a way for foreign interests, especially figures like Justin Sun, who was the number one buyer at $15 million, to steer anonymous payments to the president. Conversely, the White House defended the president, claiming he was not profiting off the presidency.
The article describes the core mechanism as consensual scamming. These tokens defy traditional finance because they will never create products or cash flow. They are literally speculation on speculation itself.
And the only consistent winners are the insiders who get in early. Creators often engineer fake trades or pay influencers to create the illusion of genuine activity and lure in retail traders, who play knowing the game is rigged but convinced they can profit by getting out just before the inevitable crash.
Crucially, the SEC declined to regulate meme coins, leaving them in a profound legal vacuum where, as one expert stated, crime is legal in crypto.
The investigation into the launch led to three key shadowy figures. First, Bill Zanker, Trump's longtime co-author and promoter, was named the authorized person for Fight LLC, the company behind the coin. He hosted the dinner for top Trumpy holders, including Justin Sun.
Second is Miles Sinclair Davis, the 29-year-old called the Phantom, linked not just to the Melania coin, but also the subsequent failed Javier Milei Libra coin. Blockchain data showed an address buying Melania before the announcement, suggesting clear insider trading.
Yes, and Davis was reportedly caught instructing traders to max extract and sell it anonymously, explicitly telling an associate, "We're trying to max extract on this one," and transferring millions of tokens with instructions to sell them once they hit a certain value. This reveals the highly capable engineering behind the extraction.
Third is Ben Eng, or Meow, the founder of the crypto exchange Meteora. Meteora was the customizable platform where the Trumps and Miley's coins debuted. While Eng denied inappropriate involvement, claiming he provided only tech support, he did admit referring business to Davis. Eng described crypto as a microcosm of the world, reflecting that people want to make money instantly and don't want to work for things. But regardless of the underlying philosophy, the meme coin craze has faded, down 92% from its peak. The Trump family has since diversified their conflict of interest portfolio into Eric's Bitcoin mining company, Saudi licensing, and prediction markets like Polymarket and Kalshi. The whole chapter serves as a cautionary tale of a market specifically engineered by highly capable people to be a maximum value extraction machine. Moving to global finance, let's discuss Japan's economy, which is experiencing a dramatic renewal, particularly in its private equity and real estate sectors. While M&A activity slowed across Asia in 2024, Japan's deal values rose 20% in 2023 and another 8% in 2024.
This market acceleration is a direct result of long-term structural reforms driven by government efforts. Specifically, the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, or MEDIDAI, and the Tokyo Stock Exchange have pushed successive corporate governance reforms, forcing companies toward better capital efficiency and divesting non-core assets. This has made foreign investors account for more than half of all trading activity on Japanese stock exchanges.
And this acceleration creates a huge succession opportunity. Japan has roughly 3.6 million companies, many family-run, and aging owners are looking for generational transitions. This creates a rich landscape for succession deals and mid-market carve-outs for private equity.
And the premium currency in these deals is trust. PE firms like T Capital Partners, which has never recorded a realized loss, specialize in trust-based partnerships. Sellers will often choose a lower bid if they believe the buyer will protect employees and the company legacy. Koji Sasaki of T Capital emphasizes that this cultural shift, emphasizing capital efficiency without sacrificing legacy, is irreversible.
Beyond private equity, Japan's real estate system is undergoing a digital renaissance, described using the analogy of kintsugi, the art of repairing broken pottery with gold to create something stronger. Instead of patching old systems, they're filling gaps in data and transparency with digital gold.
This is driven by government initiatives like MLIT's Plat2 3D City program, which is one of the world's most advanced public digital twin ecosystems, and the shift toward fully digital contracts. This creates a transparent, data-rich foundation that drives informed investment.
And developers are leading the charge. Tsuki Holdings, formed from the merger of a traditional developer and an IoT-focused tech company, delivered its best performance, focusing on IoT-enabled residential development.
Their AI-powered SaaS platform, Zizaday Land, initially built as an internal tool, is now used by over 200 companies and is preparing for international rollout. This hybrid model recurring software revenue layered onto an asset-heavy business is built for resilience in volatile markets.
They are also tackling a huge social problem: Japan's nearly 9 million vacant homes. Tsuki launched a revitalization program to restore neglected properties and reintroduce them as rentals or sales, turning an urgent social issue into stable, income-generating properties, especially targeting micro-markets emerging around transit hubs. After all the high finance and political tension, we need a vacation, or at least a look at where the economy and culture are intersecting on a global level. Our final segment looks at the destinations worth exploring in 2026, filtered through the lens of economic and cultural significance.
We can organize these destinations into key travel trends that reflect the big picture we've been discussing. The first trend is the rise of the domestic prism, where all of America's economic and cultural contradictions play out in one place: Texas.
The source calls Texas the prism of America. It's hosting the FIFA World Cup, the F1 Grand Prix, and launching the Texas Stock Exchange, or Y'all Street. It's the focus point for the U.S.'s 250th anniversary and the midterms. Its contradictions are vast: vaqueras and venture capital, strict political laws, alongside massive influxes of progressive populations.
The economic draw is undeniable, with generous tax structures luring tech giants like Oracle, Meta, Goldman Sachs, and billionaires like Musk and Bezos. We see this in the city snapshots. Houston is highlighted for its exceptional culinary diversity, boasting 70 cuisines, and its free art spaces like the Manil Collection.
Then you have the economic influx clearly visible in towns like Round Top, the dusty town overrun twice annually by antique flea market traders. The scene is described as having half of LA is here, reflecting the huge national influx, driving up prices and competition even for antiques.
And Austin is no longer the hippie enclave it once was. It's now characterized by the F1 Grand Prix and massive tech development, though the leather shops still define the place, with Lucci's bootmaker selling handmade boots alongside more accessible options like Tecova's Ropers. Dallas and Fort Worth showcase the rivalry between cosmopolitan finance and traditional cowboy and cowgirl culture, now influenced heavily by the Yellowstone halo.
The second major trend we see is the pursuit of authenticity and culture preservation against the pressure of development. We see this beautifully in Mexico and Guyana.
In Michoacán, Mexico, the monarch butterfly migration coincides with the Day of the Dead. The Mazahua community sees the butterflies as the souls of their ancestors returning. They are leveraging this heritage through the new Casa de la Cultura Mazahua using cultural tourism, their beautiful lomillo embroidery, traditional meals, shaman blessings, to combat economic pressures.
They're turning deep cultural heritage into a form of stable, non-extractive income.
And you can contrast that with Guyana, which is being called the next Dubai, due to ExxonMobil's oil boom, generating $7.5 billion in revenue since 2019. But the focus is on supporting the burgeoning ecotourism industry, based in Amerindian communities and eco-lodges like Rewa and Cayman House, supported by new infrastructure. The major concern is maintaining the country's unique culture and preserving the rainforest in the face of rapid oil-driven change.
We also see the trend of seeking longevity and altitude, focusing on wellness and avoiding crowded Mediterranean spots.
This takes us to Greece's mountains, avoiding the overcrowded islands for the Pindus Alps and Arcadia. These spots offer luxury at under $500 a night, protected by over 1,000 environmental laws limiting new construction. And Sardinia in Italy is drawing attention thanks to its Blue Zone designation for longevity and new direct Delta flights from NYC, bringing in luxury hotels like Belmond and Mandarin Oriental.
And finally, the trend of cultural rediscovery in Europe's new corners.
This includes Extremadura in Spain, home to Roman architecture, and the 3-Michelin-star Atrio restaurant. accessible via the Al-Andalus train. And north of Sardinia is Corsica, France's beautiful island neighbor, where new luxury stays are opening, and the Orient Express Corinthian sailing yacht is offering deep exploration of its ancient citadels.
And let's not forget Vienna, which has surpassed 2 million residents for the first time since before World War I, fueled by immigrants and artists. This has created a surge of creative energy, blending modern design and new hotels like the Hoxton and Mandarin Oriental with sophisticated next-gen cuisine.
We also look at Scotland's The Hebrides, 500 rugged islets now accessible via a new Abercrombie and Kent cruise. Even here, the luxury market is moving in, with LVMH opening Ardbeg House for whiskey tastings near the ancient Kalani Standing Stones.
And the high-stakes conservation challenge in India, which is home to two-thirds of the world's wild tigers. Tiger tourism is booming, projected to hit $5.3 billion by 2035, but competition for permits is fierce. The challenge is balancing high-concentration tourism with maximizing viable, unused habitat that could support up to 20,000 more tigers. This was an extraordinary deep dive into the January 2026 sources. What stands out to me, Chris, is the central defining tension of the year. This profound speculative exuberance, the AI bubbles, the crypto casinos, existing right alongside deep cultural uncertainty, whether that's Target's lost cool factor or the struggle to prove humanity online.
Absolutely. The tension is almost palpable. We saw it in Hollywood wrestling with AI, in the Democratic Party struggling to define its future, and in the luxury market where shoppers are moving from new goods to secondhand steals in a quest for perceived value.
So what does this all mean? What's the final implication that ties together Stargate, the meme coins, or the fast casual salad crisis?
The common thread running through the most successful, most risky, and most controversial ventures we discussed, from Oracle's $300 billion AI gamble to the Trump's meme coin operation, is the immediate, overwhelming quest for maximum value extraction. It's a rush to capitalize on attention and hype before the inevitable collapse, regardless of the underlying fundamental value.
And that leads to our final provocative thought for you to consider as you navigate 2026. In a world where AI has learned to perfectly mimic us, and we must constantly try to prove we are real by changing our own behavior, like banning the M-dash or asking job applicants to name their Hogwarts house, the most challenging question isn't, what will the machines do next? But rather, what human instincts, good or bad, did we train the machines to reflect, and are we now trying to hide from ourselves?
A profound question to take with you as you assess the risks and opportunities ahead. Thank you for diving deep into these sources with us today.
We'll see you next time as you explore your own sources and continue your deep dive.